and people who lost power yesterday certainly agree with the president. But whose responsibility is it? And who has to foot the bill? Two members of New York's congressional delegation are in the crossfire and without air conditioning. Democrat Anthony Weiner, Republican Vito Fisella.
Gentlemen, both thank you for joining us. Good of you to do so. Congressman Fisella, on June 6, 2001, House roll call vote number 169, you voted against investing $350 million in loans to upgrade and update the power grid. Were you wrong to vote that way?
No. First off, let me commend the people of New York and indeed all Americans who dealt with the power outage yesterday with good grace. And I got to say, couldn't be more proud than our fellow citizens. But the reality
but
is...
You would not have had to show that grace, perhaps, if you had voted to upgrade and update the power grid. Do you regret the vote against updating the power grid?
Okay, now can I answer? The reality is that we need to make improvements to our system. We need to provide incentives to the marketplace. You know, we're here on Wall Street where people make billions and indeed trillions of dollars change hands every day. And if there ever was a wake-up call, it was yesterday, to provide sufficient capacity to address the siting requirements that have limited the ability of investors to provide the capacity, and also to ensure that there's reliability standards that are enforceable. We can't just have people across the country to say no to everything. As demand grows 30% over the last 10 years and capacity grows by 10%, sooner or later something's going to happen. Indeed, yesterday was the wake-up call. So I think we need to stand together to ensure and provide incentives to the private sector and not just wave a wand and think that something's going to happen. Just as a car needs gas to go, our country needs power to run.
Congressman Weiner, the proposal that Paul was talking about was amendment by Democratic Congressman Sam Farr of California. It's as phony as a $3 bill. As a matter of fact, it is only a loan. The loan would only go into effect if the Secretary of Energy said so. It would take an emergency, and then you would only get the loan if money in the private sector was not available. It has so many caveats. Isn't it true that if you had passed that, it would have had no effect on what happened yesterday?
Well, we wouldn't have had to pass that if in the 106th Congress when President Clinton proposed putting real stiff standards that all energy power companies had to put into place, if that hadn't been killed by the Republicans who kept saying, oh, deregulation, isn't it great? Yeah, deregulation is great. Someone burns their toast in Ohio and we lose billions of dollars of revenue here in New York City, or there's a storm in Canada and we're all stuck in subway trains for hours on end. We have to reach a point where energy deregulation has gotten us Enron, higher prices, and now blackouts. I'm not so sure it's been such a great deal. And in a zeal for the Republicans to try to embarrass Gray Davis and Bill Clinton, we now have no standards in place, no loan guarantees in place, and blackouts all over New York City.
Surely you're not saying the electrical industry is deregulated. It's one of the most regulated industries in America.
Well, since power deregulation, when we started worshiping at the altar of letting the private sector do these things, they haven't had a very good track record. Now, have they, Bob?
I would respectfully sort of disagree with my good friend Anthony Weiner. The reality is that there are millions of people across the country who rely upon investments by the private sector. And over the last 10, 15 years I mentioned before, we just haven't had the sufficient capacity to meet our demand. And now it's easy to say no to everything.
Electrical industry is the most regulated industry in the country. I've heard it all. These six CNN crossfired bozos take no shame and have no shame at the low-level death they take common sense and knowledge to. Mark my word, this sham of an economic, ecological, market-based system is going to collapse and sink in its own filth. Unfortunately, millions of people are going to go with it. This nonsense about we need to make incentives to the investors. Incentives mean what? More deregulations? More nuclear plants? More dependency on fossil fuels? So American cities can look more and more like blacked out Brazil and Rio? Blacked out segments of India where privatized Gestapos have just blanked out whole regions? And this nonsense about who's responsible for 50 million people being without power. as if you don't know. The same deregulating energy barons, privatizing buffoons, and systems you always bow your little head to. Shut the hell up. It's slave time. Shit, just... You're listening to 104.1, 93.7 San Francisco, 96.3 Santa Cruz, 106.5 Illinois, LUBER.com, the World Slave Revolt Radio Time. Tonight we got Gerald shooting his way into the Making It Plain news update as he'll deal with the sham that is deregulation in the power industry. But then we're going to explore in Adventures in Corporate Media Land segment the sham of the industry of the economic and farming systems and what it is doing from a military standpoint to a food standpoint. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1 Slave Revolt Radio.
Down. Some enemies. In fact, I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we had an audience this large and didn't realize that there were some enemies present.
Good evening, brothers and sisters. I'm Gerald Smith, and this is your Making It Plain News Service. Well, as we can all see right now, capitalism fouls things up. Some people believe that the recent blackout was an act of God, a product of the chaos theory, an honest mistake. I would like to submit to you that none of the above are true, and I'm going to point at the real source of the problem, and hopefully you will agree. First of all, understand that this is not the first blackout in New York or anywhere else. We've had a few out here in California ourselves. 1965, there was a blackout in New York, and in 1977, that was the famous one when everybody went around looting and carrying out. So there have been blackouts before, and the danger of blackouts are so imminent that any company that deals in finances or that issues its own credit card, I've noticed as an electrician that goes around installing their equipment, they always install UPSs. This is how much confidence they have in the energy grid. What is a UPS? It's uninterrupted power source. That is, a while back before we were having the rolling blackouts, if you recall, the employers started to put in these uninterrupted power sources because they knew that the power was going to go down periodically. And here's something else. All right, so we have this blackout, right? Boy, does capitalism foul things up. Why did we have the blackout? Well, brothers and sisters, in spite of hours of reading, the sad news that I have to tell you right now is I don't know. And I don't know because we don't know. And we don't know because nobody's talking. What you have is mutual recrimination. In fact, this is almost out of South Park now, if you saw South Park the movie. The Canadians explained that a piece of lightning, a bolt of lightning, hit a plant in northern upstate New York. But the Americans, well, blame Canada. They are definitely blaming Canada. And there you go. No, he did. Yes, he did. No, he did. Yes, he did. And I'm trying to think of a why. They can't even be honest about a little baby thing like this. Come on. Did something happen? Let's get to the bottom of it. Let's correct it. Hell no. Last time there was a power outage that was clearly defined in California, power only went out. Oh, yeah, power was out for about 7 hours, I think, and it was traced back to a technician of PG&E who made a mistake. Well, PG&E had to pay out millions of dollars because they were sued in court. So now, capitalism fouls things up because these guys, they're not accountable. There is no regulation, as Tracy pointed out before. The regulation thing is pretty much gone. I mean, you know, even the price regulation, you think that you got somebody looking out for you on these boards when they come asking for the increase in your fees? Don't kid yourself. No. The regulation is pretty much almost non-existent, you see? And therefore, there's nobody controlling these people. Now, when there's nobody controlling people, well, then how do you get any justice out of that situation or the truth? People go to the courts. They turn to the courts. And most of the time, you're going to the wrong place if you're looking for justice, even if you do get a little money. So, since PG&E or any other power company realizes that they may be sued, they ain't talking. You can forget that. And then there's another problem. Now, today, there are more than one power company. All right? There are more than one. Investors, you know, give money to different sources, and they build power plants, and that goes on the grid. And what this leads to, unfortunately, is a situation where you have... All right, they had an article in the Chronicle today, and they were talking about this chaos theory and the problem, you know, is it just a matter of chaos? The more sophisticated you get, the more chaotic things can get, or the more overwhelming a problem can get if one part of the system flakes out, right? But dig this, and this is something to think about. They said, look, these guys who study this through computers have had trouble developing more sophisticated models for blackouts, partly because the power companies have been reluctant to share information for proprietary reasons, specifically details about how their systems fail. Well, I'll be damned. So they don't want to get sued. They don't want their competitors to know what they got going on. So the blackout is 24/7 in terms of trying to understand our own. But basically, what do we know? Here's what we do know, all right? We know that the common cause for blackouts is too much energy being forced through too few transmission lines, in a nutshell. Now, there is also the question of when a particular... There are some power plants that run off the electricity of other power plants. So if another power plant goes out, it causes another plant to go out where there was nothing wrong. And then there's the question of safety. Today, they have switches that cut off power plants to prevent the equipment from being damaged if there's some problem. So here you have a combination of probabilities and problems. I honestly and fortunately can say I don't know exactly what occurred, but I know this. Don't buy it when they say that this is inevitable. Number one, the grid can be. We have a grid that is, in California, we already know it's aging equipment. We know this. This is not, you know, an opinion. Well, okay, if it's aging equipment, why don't they upgrade it? Well, because most of it is not publicly owned. You try going telling PG&E they got to upgrade all their wire. They got to upgrade all their material. Look, I can tell you, no mechanical device or media form. When I talk about media form, I'm talking about copper or silver bus. I'm talking about wire, aluminum wire, copper wire. I'm talking about the things that electricity goes through, the medium, right? None of that stuff lasts forever. And I can tell you, it's likely that they have charts, scientific charts, that will tell you that after X number of years, given so many volts and amps going through a certain size wire, that wire will be worn out. The temperature is constantly changing. The electricity is molecules pushing through there. That wire can get worn out. Now, it may take a long time. I'm not saying that the wire itself is worn out. It is more likely other mechanical devices are in need of being upgraded or, you know, just changed, you know. But this is a scientific question. This should never be a matter for a single owner to decide that, well, no, I didn't get all my money back yet. I ain't buying no new shit. What you talking about? But that's the way it is now.
A lot of it has to do with them just looking at it as the same way that Horowitz looked at the trees in Mendocino County. Is this something to make a super profit on?
That's right.
And the least amount of investment that you make, and the more profit bang off the buck, the better, quote-unquote, businessman you are. So they know how much there's a need to repair the grids and things like that. But they're not interested in that, and they want to force all of that off on the taxpaying public and every other thing.
Or the next sucker that buys the company from them.
But we're also dealing with an outmoded mode of production. The whole fossil fuel and base industry that they're relying on as a way of generating power, the whole nuclear industry and all of that, that whole system has basically seen its time pass, starting in the 1960s. And there's been countries throughout the world that have started to invest in wind power and solar cells, you know, that have been far advanced at this point to where this is how a civilized society would start to reconstruct itself. But these guys are truly regulators. They want to regulate, i.e. control the market, these privatizers. So they do not want people going into living energy systems when they can control the coal, fossil fuel, and nuclear power industry through all the lobbying and, you know, and it's a particular product that it's a limited resource and things like that. It's much easier to continue to manipulate that means of production for their own economic benefit, regardless of the global warming costs and all the other things that are happening.
That's right. And I'd venture to say that, look, that so therefore, what is necessary is to break out of that shell of this outmoded form of production. And that means, here it comes, y'all. Yes, it means a revolution to create socialism. It's the only way you're going to get around. At least you'll be able to find out what caused the damn blackout. I tell you that for sure. But more importantly, you start to see what happened in New York. They were amazed. The bourgeoisie was amazed because they didn't call no curfew or nothing like that. And people didn't go off. People were just as sociable, helping each other out, you know, helping elderly people get out the subway and stuff like that. Nobody died, apparently. Amazing. You know, and that's good. That's real good. But there were things that occurred that didn't have to occur. Let me give you an example. I wasn't always an old beat-up mechanic. I was once an apprentice, and I remember when I was an apprentice, whenever we built a public building or any large building, we created an emergency electrical system. All right, now what did this look like? Usually in the basement somewhere, they would have a huge generator that ran off of diesel fuel, usually. If there was a problem with the electricity coming inside from PG&E, they had a transfer switch that would automatically turn on, and it would turn the generator on, which would then start the emergency power system so that the lights would still work, etc., etc., you know? Now, these developers, they couldn't go for that because that's expensive. To build that kind of a, you know, with the, you know, all that it takes to build that alternative system, they said, oh, no, we can't have this. We don't need, what we need is not this here. We need to just create isolated lights in the building that work off of batteries. And so I noticed we started to install these lights, these little exit lights with the batteries in them. And every, you know, 10th light or so, they'd put a light in with those batteries, see? And that became a substitute for the emergency power system. So in other words, they could spend a few thousand dollars for what usually would cost $20,000 or $30,000 in the building of a building. Wow, they save money. Yes, they save money, but at what cost to you? Now, you heard about people getting stuck, for instance, in elevators in New York. And that's, you know, we're talking buildings with 50 stories, 60 stories here. That they would allow people to build buildings and elevator systems with no emergency power system of its own, at least to go back down to the first floor and let people out, is absolutely baffling. People getting stuck in elevators. And can you imagine in some situations there might have been 15 people in an elevator? Totally unnecessary. Except, of course, if you want to save that $20,000. You understand what I'm getting at here, folks? Capitalism fouls things up. So what we see is we don't need, sometimes there are some expenses that are in the interest of the people to be spent. We want emergency power systems in our buildings. That's a good thing to have. All right? We want to refurbish the electrical grid. Yes, that's a good thing to happen. And we know why it is not happening, despite Bush's phony propaganda to the contrary. You know, he of course got in on the deal and said, oh, we should build up the grid. Let's see if he come up with any legislation to that effect. That's how you know when they're serious. They could get a law passed.
Well, let's see who's going to end up paying for any kind of rebuilding of the grid. That's one of the key things. If they just pass it off on the taxpayer, then we're back to square one, or actually beyond square one, because we're still dealing with a outmoded means of energy in the first place.
Right.
Now, the fact that they don't have or not concerned with putting emergency systems in buildings and stuff like that, these are the same people that don't want emergency health care systems for the right. masses of the population.
Well,
it's the same people, same concept, and same mentality and priorities, where it prioritizes their profit well and above the masses of human beings in this country and around the planet.
You know, when Tracy talk about outmoded, you know, production system, that ain't just rhetoric. Look, let me give you a clear example. Years ago, they started putting the solar cells on individual houses, if you so desire. It costs about $30,000, well, $25,000. I know a fella in Concord who's got it, you know? And I quizzed him on it, you know? I said, well, damn, is it worth it? You know, we went back and forth. And he explained to me, well, because in Concord they do get a lot of sunlight, he basically doesn't have to pay for any electricity. In fact, most of the year, even when he has his air conditioning on, PG&E, like what happens is he produces more electricity on his electrical grid, on his solar cells, than he can use. So that excess of electricity goes onto the grid and serves, you know, just goes into a general, you know, so everyone can use it. So he pays very little. Now everybody else is paying enormous amounts. Last year, they jacked our stuff up, okay? So just in a functional way, in a very simple way, that solar, it works on houses. How come they didn't start building it on houses when the houses were built? That's all. You see, if you're in an area where there's a lot of sunshine, like Concord, now, you know, down here there's less sunshine. I don't know scientifically, would it work as well down here, because we have a lot of fog and stuff like that. But the time to do it, once you see that it works, every time a house is built, it should just be on top of the house as standard equipment. And this way, we'd save, we don't even know how much electricity we'd save. Why doesn't this happen? Because capitalism fouls things up. PG&E would have a fit if that became standard equipment on every new building in the state of California. Would you want...
Well, a lot of privatizers were involved in dismantling the development of solar energy. When Ronald Decrypt Reagan hit office, one of the first things he did was have the solar panel cells torn off the White House and thrown out in front of his little mansion. Now, various authors, like the authors who wrote Who Stole the Sun, document very well the history of solar development. And if you combine that with wind power development, the system within California and the country could be vastly revitalized because of the types of jobs people can get, and reworked into a life energy system instead of this death energy. That's why they call it fossil fuel. But like I said before, it's all about the whole private market and controlling the market and controlling the resources by those corporate plunderers. And they have their not only mentality, but they have their particular priorities. And their priorities is not establishing or allowing a system to come in place without some major fight in which they lose to take place, where alternative means of energy systems are used by the public and for the public interest. That's just not in, it's not in their genes. So it's just not going to happen without some massive overhaul of
the political system
and destruction of the state as it stands.
Because capitalism fouls things up. But we're going to start right now in advocating the nationalization or the municipalization of all utilities. Water, phone, gas, telephone, cable, all of that. All utilities should be nationalized without compensation.
A lot of these same guys have been running around, like I mentioned in the beginning when I blew up these CNN crossfire fools. These are the same guys who've been running around Brazil, and they thrust Rio de Janeiro into major blackouts. They have been thrusting parts of India into 7-10 hour blackouts at a time. These are the same ones. They've been trying to privatize all forms of energies. They started off in Britain under the whole Thatcher program. And some corporate plunderers in America loved that and started to try to follow in that model. Now you have international forces, not just U.S. forces, talking about corporate forces, who are engaged in privatizing the industry and doing everything they can to privatize the energy systems so that they can maximize their particular profit. And the same thing that is happening into these third world nations that has already happened, they're trying to bring it here. This is the whole Enron debacle thing, in just another vein that what happened in New York. The Enron plunderers who were stacking power and who were doing, had all these code words for the various tricks like Death Star and all of that, they were manipulating the market.
Right.
Kinley and all of these clowns should be in prison. But we have a system and a political system that is down for that particular thing. That's why Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's trying to make a go for being the governor, is out front meeting or had met with Kinley when that whole energy crisis was going on. These are the types of alignments and agreements these types of people have, that no matter how discredited on a true level the deregulation system in privatized hands has proven to be, you keep pushing forward, even if we end up all being under the ocean through global warming.
Yeah. the United States might be an ocean, they keep this up. Well, look, brothers and sisters, remember, capitalism fouls things up. And therefore, we want to municipalize, collectivize, or nationalize all utilities in the United States. We can't let these son of a guns get their hands on our water. And, you know, they like, the black comedians like to make jokes about, you know, them starting to charge for air. And he said, brother, stop breathing. He said, what? He said, man. He said, could you change my air to my mama's name? No. Listen, we don't want to go with none of that madness. Let's put it in the hands of the people. In fact, let's put all our resources in the hands of the people. And that means let's go forward to socialism. Okay, now here I got an interesting little... get this. North Korea next to hear U.S. war drum. A senior Pentagon advisor has given details of a war strategy for invading North Korea and toppling its regime within 30 to 60 days. Adding muscle to a lobbying campaign by U.S. hawks urging a preemptive military strike against Pyongyang's nuclear facility. Now, you know, facilities, rather. We should make this clear. First of all, Clinton tried to get a war going against North Korea. No doubt about it. So when he tried to get a little war going, he called up the leader of South Korea and said, look, we're going to start dropping bombs on them, and then y'all attacking, and you either. And the dude said to him, he said, oh, no. No, 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 no. Because what you think they're going to be doing when you're dropping your bombs on them? They're gonna fire over here at South Korea and be killing our people up. We're getting along fine, thank you. There ain't no problem. These people is family. We done started letting people go across the border. Things are getting better between North Korea and South Korea. Please, sir. No, they argued actually a number of times because Clinton really wanted war with North Korea. Well, less than 4 months after the end of the Iraq War, the war drums in Washington have begun pounding again. A growing number of influential U.S. leaders are talking openly of military action against North Korea to destroy its nuclear weapons program, and even those who prefer negotiations are warning of the mounting danger of war. And I want you to think, listen to the argument that the Pentagon has given, and then we'll see, is this real or is this just huffing and puffing going on? Some analysts predict that North Korea could test a nuclear warhead by the end of this year, an event that could cross the, quote, red line that would provoke a U.S. attack. The tensions were heightened by a recent exchange of gunfire across the border between North Korea and South Korean soldiers. Talks between U.S. and North Korean officials are expected to be held in Beijing soon, but nobody is predicting an imminent diplomatic agreement, especially after the North Korea denounced a U.S. negotiator as a bloodsucker and human scum. Well, might be right. Military conflict in the Korean Peninsula could trigger a catastrophe, not only because of the suspected presence of nuclear bombs in North Korea, but also because of the 11,000 North Korean artillery weapons along the border that could inflict death and destruction on millions of people in the South Korean capital of Seoul, which is within artillery range of the North's guns. Former CIA Director James Wolseley, a Pentagon advisor and close ally of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, gave the most explicit glimpse into the thinking of U.S. military planners this week when he revealed the details of a possible plan of attack against North Korea. The plan would include 4,000 daily airstrikes against North Korean targets, the deployment of cruise missiles, and stealth aircraft to destroy the Yongbyon nuclear plant and other nuclear facilities. The stationing of U.S. Marine forces off the coast of North Korea to threaten a land attack on North Korea. The deployment of two additional U.S. Army divisions, y'all hear this? To bolster South Korean troops in a land offensive against North Korea. And the call up of National Guard and reserve units to replace U.S. combat forces that are currently bogged down in Iraq and Afghanistan. Stop! Why is this just bluster? I'm telling you right now, they ain't going to do shit. Now, what is this Negro talking about? Well, I'm going to tell you what I'm talking about. Number one, there's holes in this argument, right? Number one, I do not believe that they have the finances to pay for 4,000 bombs and stuff a day. Those bombs cost money. And homeboy is getting kind of broke. That's why they're going around trying to get everybody to send their troops to stay in Iraq. Because it costs money to feed the troops.
And shamelessly cutting their little G.I. Joe's salary.
Oh, that's the next thing I was going to get to. So obviously, old Sam is getting a little short. Old boy George is on the bag. He going around trying to get the Polish people to get in there and occupy. And let's spread this around. Now, also, the deployment of two additional U.S. Army divisions. Dang, where are these two divisions going to come from? They cannot pull them out of their nose, y'all. Ain't nobody joining that raggedy-ass army right now. Americans, unfortunately, my brothers and sisters, are chicken shit. Right now, they got this war going on. Ain't nobody joining now. People was joining when they figured you could get in there on a free ride, sit around, you know, with your, kicking. Somebody say, turn up, you just stand up and make like you're waving to them and go and get your money and do your thing. $30,000 to go to college. What the hell? No, this thing done changed. These fools actually going around making you go to work somewhere and do something. And you might actually get killed. Nobody's joining their little funky army. Except a few deranged elements who have a death wish. But, I mean, on the whole, ain't a whole lot. That $30,000 for that college education ain't looking too good right now. Okay? And lastly, they talking about they gonna call up the National Guard and the reserve units. They already have. That is totally depleted. They called them up and sent them to Iraq. What do they think, we stupid? No, they think we don't know. They think we can't remember from day to day. They think they can say anything. Quote, massive air power is the key to being able to both to destroy North Korea and to protect South Korea from attack by missile or artillery. That's ridiculous. If they started to drop bombs on North Korea, you can bet they would immediately start to try to do everything they could to attack the American forts located in South Korea or near the border. Mr. Wolsey wrote, all right, in the Wall Street Journal, in an article co-written by retired Air Force General McKerny. Mm-hmm. We believe the use of air power in such a war would be swifter and more devastating than it was in Iraq, the article said. We judge that the U.S. and South Korea could defeat North Korea decisively in 30 to 60 days with such a strategy. Hold the fort, y'all. First of all, what you mean we, white man? South Koreans don't want none. They done already made it really clear. They don't want none, okay? Secondly, 30 to 60 days? Tracy, did we ever hear this before? Did anybody ever talk about they was going to defeat something in 30 to 60 days? Right now.
And then have all the people from that country whose government they defeated come cheering them with red roses.
But it's true. They thought they won in Iraq. They thought they brought it to an end. And it's only about to begin. We see a resistance growing every day in Iraq. And you can bet, here's the other thing, North Korea ain't toe up like Iraq was. There's very likely to be some substantial resistance. I also have to say, I don't know the condition of the North Korean Air Force. Will they just have they been under the no-fly rule? Have all of their planes been destroyed? Are they prostrate, laying there just waiting to get bombed? No, bro. I think this is called, there's a word for this. This is called Huey. BS. Bombast. They acknowledge the risk that U.S. military strikes could trigger an explosion of radiation from North Korean nuclear plants, along with massive artillery attacks against Seoul by the North Korean heavy guns that are hidden in hardened underground bunkers on the border. but U.S. cruise missiles and stealth aircraft could launch precision bombing attacks that would, quote, minimize radiation leakage. These are sick people. While also sealing shut the underground bunkers where the artillery pieces are hidden, they have active imaginations, too. They warned that the war could soon become necessary to prevent North Korea from selling weapon-grade plutonium to rogue states and terrorist organizations. The world has weeks to months, at most, to deal with this issue, not months to years, Mr. Woolsey and Lieutenant General McNerney wrote. If they wrote it, I don't know these people, I'm telling you. No, I say, they're now Tracy went and snatched my thunder. Yeah, you did, because the next thing I was going to point out was that the Pentagon wants to cut the pay of 148,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, who are already contending with guerrilla-style attacks, homesickness, and 120 degrees plus heat. Okay, to make the story, you know, really clear, they were going to get a $75 a month imminent danger pay raise and $150 a month in family separation allowances. So if you left people home, you get 150 extra bucks. Well, guess what, Trace? This is what I think is interesting. The families hit the damn roof. They said, what? Say what? And accordingly, they had to back up off them. And they did. They let the increases go through. And why? Why so? Why would they let the increases go through? Well, you see, brothers and sisters, when you're in the United States Army, you're in there and you're under their discipline. That's true. But this is a volunteer army. They can't just do anything they want to people, because then how are they going to get some new suckers to line up? You see? So it's interesting. Be aware, Trace. The family started raising hell. They backed up off them. And they gave up the raise.
Well, they've been raising hell about a number of things. They haven't gotten all their demands. They even have a website up and all of that type of stuff, because a large contingent of them want the troops home.
Right.
Because they're fully aware of the depleted uranium stuff. There's much evidence that the so-called pneumonia is actually the effects of depleted uranium, and that the U.S. government, along with a lot of other things they've been hiding, has been hiding that. Now, we know that number of people have died from this so-called
pneumonia
stuff, dry pneumonia in Iraq.
120 degrees pneumonia.
But their own reports, scientific reports that they had commissioned years ago on some of the effects of depleted uranium showed that these are the types of effects, amongst other things, that you get.
Okay, but you know, while you're right, the point I'm trying to make is that, unfortunately, a lot of people tend to think that once old Boy George and them come up, because Boy George endorsed the Pentagon pay cut, all right, his office endorsed it. But guess what? In the real world, they can't do anything they want. They can't attack with troops that they don't have. They can't make bombs with money they don't have.
Well, that's pretty obvious. I mean, they already have a demoralized army. The fact that the 34th Regiment, or the 3rd Regiment, that was told that if they had the first into Baghdad is the first home. So they put on their cowboy boots after running into Kuwait for a while and rushed into Baghdad. They thought that their prize was going to be them get to go home first, because they made the little gallant move and all of that type of stuff. Lo and behold, Cheney and all of them start talking like, you ain't coming home till we tell you you're coming home, and we don't know when that's going to be. And they kept pushing them off and off and off, and you had screams and outcries from friends and family members of the G.I. Joes. And some of the G.I. Joes were talking smack about, they would tell Cheney and Rumsfeld to resign and stuff like that. And they finally sent the troops home. So some of the concessions that these troops have been winning has been happening for a while, because they're in such a precarious situation. So the fact that this is another one is just the highlight, the precariousness that the U.S. empire is in. They got their boots all over the place, from Afghanistan to Saudi Arabia Japan. You know, they're causing trouble and kicking up dust. Got a few people creeping in all over parts of Africa, not just Liberia and stuff like that, to make sure that Firestone's safe, but other places too.
Okay, so thank you very much, Bill. We gonna close this out on this whole. This is out of England, The Guardian. It's called The U.S. Race and War. Get this, y'all. This is a critique of the United States government's ally, Tony Blair. As America's most eloquent minister for war, Tony Blair has often taken it upon himself to placate criticism of the United States military aggression abroad by pointing to its social achievements at home. And there can be few greater American accomplishments in his mind than race. Get this. Quite how he came to this ill-informed conclusion and why he would choose to share it is not entirely clear. He rarely mentions race domestically. The last time there were riots in the North, he didn't even venture to go up there to see what had sparked them. So when he raises it about America, it exposes both his weakness on the subject in Britain and his ignorance of its dynamic in America. In the Labor Party conference speech of 2001, where he made the case for the bombing of Afghanistan, he hailed a meritocracy that could produce a black foreign secretary. I think of a black man born in poverty who became chief of their armed forces and is now Secretary of State, Colin Powell, and I wonder frankly whether such a thing could have happened here, he said. Leave aside for the moment that Powell was not born into poverty. The truth is that as Prime Minister, Blair could appoint a black person to the post of Foreign Secretary anytime he wants. The fact that it took him 5 years to put Paul Boating in a far lowlier position in his own cabinet is down to nobody but himself. A few weeks ago, addressing Congress to justify the war in Iraq, he was at it again. Tell the world why you are proud of America, he implored. Tell them when the Star Spangled Banner starts, Americans get to their feet, not because some state official told them to, but because whatever race, color, class, or creed they are, being American means being free. He might have asked himself how far his policies on asylum seekers, ID cards, and immigration, not to mention the reckless language and bigoted logic of his Home Secretary, David Blunkin, have put back the day when black, Asian, and Muslim Britons might feel similarly comfortable with their own national identity. But what is most staggering about his use of race in his tributes to Uncle Sam is not that the accomplishments he supports in America are the very ones he is so busily stifling at home. It is that the very cause in which he raises them, war, has the least backing among those whose experience he uses to marvel at America's greatness, that is, black people. It is not difficult to see why. If America's achievements in race relations are exemplary, then someone forgot to tell African Americans, that section of the population most likely to be unemployed, poor, without health care, imprisoned, executed, and arrested. And if war is the best way to remedy these ills, nobody told them either. Even at the height of the popularity of the war against Iraq in April, a Pew Research Center poll found only 44% of African Americans supported it, the lowest level of any group surveyed. Overall, 66% of Americans favored the military action, with support at 77% among whites and 67% among Hispanics. Black Americans obviously shared the shock and loss of September 11th, but most did not share the righteous indignation because the notion that they could be the victims of a mindless act of deadly violence in their own country was not entirely new. Living in a state of terror was new to many white people in America, said writer Maya Angelou. But black people have been suffering in a state of terror in this country for more than 400 years. Indeed, the very man who claims to be fighting the war to make the world safe for democracy, President George Bush, came to power because black Americans in Florida were systematically denied the right to vote. Such hypocrisy may be news to Blair, but it is no revelation for African Americans. It is not just this war that irks them. They have been more skeptical than whites about every war during the past century because it has long been a staple truth of American foreign policy that the U.S. would claim to be fighting for rights abroad that it refused to extend to black people and others at home. Nor is it news to the American government. After the Second World War, tackling domestic racism was as much a foreign policy decision as anything else. A civil rights committee appointed by President Harry Truman reached the following conclusion, and I quote, "We cannot escape the fact that our civil rights record has been an issue in world politics. They have tried to prove our democracy an empty fraud and our nation a consistent oppressor of underprivileged people," unquote. It would be almost another 20 years before black Americans would be assured of the right to vote. Tied to a country by geography and nationality, yet denied full allegiance to it by politics and history, African Americans have developed a habit of looking askance when their leaders reach for their gun in the name of the greater good. But while they were sent, while the least likely to support these wars since Korea, they have been the most likely to end up fighting them. In fact, the American military is more reliant on the poor and therefore non-whites than ever before. Pushed by poverty and pulled by the promise of learning a trade, in 1973, 23% of the military was formed by racial minorities. In the year 2000, it was 37%. The demographic group most overrepresented in the military is the same one that polls show have least enthusiasm for the conflict: black women. But if black Americans' resistance to U.S. foreign policy is understandable, is not uncomplicated or unqualified. If their opposition to the war has been greater than white Americans, their support for it has also been greater than the predominantly white populations of Europe. Two of the principal people responsible for the prosecution of the war, Powell and Condoleezza Rice, are black. Herein lie the contradictions in which the late black intellectual W.E.B. Du Bois referred to as black America's double consciousness. Bar the Native Americans and a handful of pilgrims, they are the most long-standing racial group in the country. There are few who can lay a greater claim to being American than African Americans. Yet they are few who can point to as much systematic prejudice at the hands of America. Quote, "It is a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness," wrote Du Bois. "One ever feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro. Two warring souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals, one dark body, whose dog strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder." It is a nuisance that Blair clearly does not see, and given his backward racial policies in Britain, would not understand even if he did. For when they stand for the Star-Spangled Banner, they salute what they believe to be the nation's promise, not what they know to be its practice. And they are the least likely to believe that declaring war on foreign nations is the best way to fulfill that promise, because they have first-hand experience of how selective the ideals can be of those who fight them.
Well, I think what you're experiencing is a very clear illustration of the massive dependency of modern societies on vast amounts of energy consumption. And as soon as we can no longer consume and use and, of course, supply that energy, then the whole of life as we know it comes to an end, which illustrates, I think, our extreme vulnerability in several respects. First of all, the fact that, of course, the oil is running out. All the independent experts, the geologists in the oil industry, appear to be reaching pretty well a consensus now that within the next 10 or 20 years, global demand for oil will exceed supply. The result of that is that oil prices will become extremely high. The result will be that in many of the poorer countries where they can't command oil because their currencies are weak, we'll see continual blackouts like the one you're experiencing at the moment. And the further result of that is that we'll find that all electricity generation becomes more and more expensive, that there'll be a demand for other forms which are even more dangerous and problematic, such as nuclear power, now being discussed in Bush's New Energy Review, of course, and we find ourselves in even more trouble as a result. The second big impact is that because we are so hooked on this high-energy society, find ourselves inevitably contributing to massive degrees of climate change. Now, there are one or two people in the world who believe that climate change is not happening. They receive a great deal of coverage in the media. Very few of those people are climatologists. Even fewer of those people are climatologists who are not receiving money from the fossil fuel industry. Within the professional community of climatologists, the claim that there is no link between human activities and global climate change is taken as seriously as the claim that there is no link between smoking and lung cancer. It is absolutely almost 100% consensus within the community of climatologists that man-made climate change is happening, and it is happening now. Now, the official range of predictions for how far this climate change is going to go over the next century are between 1.4 and 6 degrees Celsius, centigrade. We're now seeing some scientists coming out and saying it could go up to an increase of 10 degrees centigrade. What I would point to is that so far the increase over the previous century has been just 0.6 degrees centigrade. In other words, just one-tenth of the maximum official range that the climatologists have all signed up to. And yet already we are seeing vast numbers of deaths. We are seeing extremely wild fluctuations of climate. We are seeing bizarre weather patterns which the world has not seen before. The possibility of having a 6-degree increase in global temperatures is absolutely terrifying. It effectively means the end of human life on Earth. The 6-degree increase in temperatures in most of the agricultural zones of the world, the temperature becomes too high to support crop plants. Soil moisture dries out. The water reaching rivers dwindles to nothing. The result is you can't have irrigation, you can't have rain-fed agriculture. The Earth's productivity crashes, and human beings will not have the means to survive. Great majority of the media in the United States, and indeed the great majority of the media here in Europe, are owned by a particular interest group who are the multimillionaires. And what multimillionaires want is a better world for multimillionaires, which necessarily, because it leads to enormous levels of inequality, means a worse world for everybody else. And one of the components of a better world for multimillionaires is that corporations are permitted to do exactly what they want to do. And of course that includes the oil companies, the car manufacturers, the energy generation companies, who want to be able to burn as much fossil fuel, produce as much fossil fuel as they need to in order to maintain high levels of product, high levels of profit. That activity is destroying the world, is destroying its capacity to support human life, is of no interest to them whatsoever. But it is almost a religious duty on the part of the mainstream media controlled by these multimillionaires not to discuss climate change, because if they discuss climate change, that basically gives the whole game away. It basically says the economy, the economic system we have at present is unsustainable. There is no means by which we can continue living as we do. There is no means by which the American people can continue driving their SUVs. There is no means by which we can continue to have this degree of air conditioning, this degree of vast expenditure of electricity and energy. Because if we do that, we cook the planet and we make it uninhabitable for human life. It's as simple as that. Yet that is a truth which cannot be told. If it is told, the result is a lack of confidence in the whole basis of profit making for those corporations. So, for the sake of a few years' profit, for companies which are already tremendously rich, we're going to sacrifice the possibility of survival on Earth. This is almost a perfect parable of the self-destructive nature of the existing economy, that whatever happens, the speculators must continue doing their speculation. They must continue keeping the machine going, which is ultimately destroying the planet. Nothing must be allowed to stand in their way. No truth can be told which in any way can deflate confidence in what they are doing. And this is the terrifying reality which we face at the moment, and which we, as human beings, and the media in particular, simply do not want to grasp. We find this so remote, so terrifying, the idea that the entire basis of our lives will be changed, that indeed we might not be able to live on Earth anymore as a result of climate change. We find this completely impossible to contemplate, and so we don't contemplate it. We forget it. We just bury ourselves in the moment and just imagine that what we see around us now will be how it will always be. Well, I think what's happening in New York is a very good illustration of how rapidly things can change, and just one small aspect of an economy can change. One power station can go down, and everything changes. Well, that's the sort of scale of change. In fact, it's quite minor by comparison to the sort of changes I'm talking about that we can anticipate as climate change sets in. That whole regions of the Earth become uninhabitable. The crop plants which we depend upon simply can't grow anymore. The carrying capacity of the Earth falls from its 6 billion or so to less than a billion. And the great majority of people will no longer be able to survive. We've got to get this in our heads, because unless we do, we are doomed. We have to recognize that unless we massively change our behavior and reduce our consumption of energy to 10 or 20% of what it is at present, then there is no possibility of sustaining the sort of lives that we know, the sort of lives which are in any way decent lives, beyond the next 30 or 40 years.
Media tells you the truth. The media. The media. The media. How many of you really believe that the media tells you the truth?
They lie.
For a small planet. MCI. The
pump and it automatically builds your credit card of choice. Don't you wish you could pay for everything that fast?
Now things are about to get out of hand. And for people like these, an incredible weapon has been created. Power of a computer in the palm of your hand.
The reason for this unawareness of the frightening danger to our country and to the entire free world is simple. The masterminds behind this great conspiracy have absolute control of all of our mass communications media, especially television.
All right, you know what time it is now. Ventures in Corporate Media Land. And tonight we're going to have to rush right through this segment as much as possible. It's basically dealing with how the corporate media has or has not been covering the issue of Agent Orange in various milieus. Recently, it's been revealed that around 30 years ago, dioxin that was in Vietnam in tanks or gallons had actually spilled open and contaminated into the surrounding areas and then the ecosystem at large. They were under the airport in Nam. Now, it was under Agent Orange that these gallons were actually stored, but dioxins are some of the products that are released from Agent Orange. So, in other words, it was all about the U.S. imperialist war in Vietnam. And these are some of the effects. Now, we know the effects of them just spraying Agent Orange, the dioxin effects. But these were actually barrels that have now contaminated the region. So Dr. Schecker describes some of his findings that this two-decade commission has found out in Nam as a result of the Agent Orange spillage situation. So check this out.
For the last few decades, we've been looking to see if dioxin was left over from Agent Orange and if this contaminated Vietnamese people, food, environment, and our most recent studies focused on dioxin hotspots, which exist in a small part of the country, less than 10%, but they are areas where in people extremely high levels of dioxin exist and extremely high levels of dioxin exist in food. Our newest study, published this week, showed that the levels in food as well as in people in Vietnam are as high in these hot spots as they were when Agent Orange was being sprayed. The study found high levels of contamination in duck, chicken, one type of fish only, toad, and previous studies showed elevated levels in beef and pork, snake, and turtle. The dioxin manages to move into the environment, and one way it does this is to get into the silt or sediment on the bottom of rivers or lakes, and then bottom-dwelling creatures will be contaminated with it. They, in turn, will be eaten, higher levels are eaten, and then we finally end up eating and bioconcentrating, once again, dioxins.
So here we go again. Here, the U.S. and its mechanisms of war is still having the effects of contamination and death years after its last cowboys left the shore. Now, part of the reason why I'm bringing this up is that you don't hear this type of discussion in the corporate media any more than you hear any kind of sound definition of some of the U.S. Empire's current form of death and destruction through its warfare, that being depleted uranium that it is spread throughout Bosnia, Yugoslavia, Afghanistan, and of course, Iraq. It is completely saturated, Iraq, with depleted uranium. and you are going to see similar types of catastrophes where the ecosystem in Iraq is going to be utterly thrust into chaos, and the masses of the American population is going to be trying its best to put its head back into that ostrich hole while its U.S. empire, if still in existence, which it best not be, will be galloping off elsewhere. So here you have ducks, chickens, fish, toads, beef, pork, snakes, turtles, the rivers, everything being contaminated by a lawless empire through its own weapons of mass destruction. And it has the nerve to gallop around the world and start another war with someone else under the guise of weapons of mass destruction, and the corporate media system sits idly, idly by.
Actually, they're busy confirming and supporting and licking and kissing their ass and bullshitting and confusing people.
Next, Dr. Shecker describes who and how this dioxin agent can be found and why. Check this out.
We now know that this unwanted chemical is found in all people in industrialized countries and at low levels in non-industrialized countries, usually from incineration. We know that it gets into us through animal foods, meat, poultry, fish, dairy products, and everyone has it. The question is how high or how low. We did not used to have this in our bodies 100 years ago, but it is toxic. It can cause cancer, immune deficiencies, birth problems, endocrine defects. And so this is something we try to keep at the lowest level possible in the United States as well as Vietnam. If it's incineration, in contrast to spraying it for certain locations, jungles and so on, if there's incineration, municipal garbage waste incinerators, toxic waste incinerators or whatever, the toxins will go into the air and be deposited some distance away. And if it's in a pasture, a cow would eat a large amount of grass with a small amount of dioxin in each blade of grass. But we would then eat the cow or drink milk from the cow or eat the cheese from the cow. That would be one route.
Okay, now here we go again. This is just an endless cycle. Because, see, the incinerations, many of these incineration things are in this country. So they produce these types of things to kill other people whose class interests we're aligned with. Then, of course, they dispose of some of these things that they help produce these products of death with. They incinerate them in our neighborhoods, especially in the disposable people's neighborhoods. And you know who are the disposable people. Now, as I've gone into before, this is very similar to the same way that they the same type of boomerang cycle that happens with the depleted uranium. There's over 100 Superfund sites in America. A number of them have been contaminated by a number of things, products that they make for weapons of mass destruction or weapons of mass destroying indigenous people and throughout the world. And one of them is depleted uranium. And depleted uranium samples have been found in the bark 10 miles downstream of some of these Superfund sites in America. So they have to make them somewhere. They're making them here. It's contaminating the population here. It's contaminating groundwater here. And then they take those weapons after they develop them here and go bomb up more disposable people and use G.I. Joe soldiers who are disposable, and the cycle continues. This is the hallmark of a ruthless, lawless gangster society.
It sure is. I just want to say, Tracy, did they close down that incinerator on High Street where what they were burning up was hospital equipment, which turns to dioxin?
Right. Well, after they got into that situation where they had been turning down the computers to they were supposed to regulate the level, and they almost created a whole catastrophe by some other stuff, they've kind of had to keep it on the back burner for at least a little while, meaning the production of them burning this stuff. But it's been an ongoing fight.
So they're still burning it, though, right now?
Or temporarily it's closed.
Okay.
Next, Dr. Shecker describes the 5,000 gallons of this Agent Orange leak underground near the airbase in Nam and some of the long and short-term effects. Check this out.
Well, the leak has caught everyone's attention, and there was, in fact, a very large leak. But in addition, there was spraying and dumping of excess Agent Orange when the airplanes left or came back to their airbase at Bin Hoa. So it was both spraying and a leakage. We believe the leakage led to underground movement through the groundwater into the nearby lake, where the dioxin would then attach to the sediment, the biomatter in sediment, and then be eaten. We're seeing a consequence of war. We're also seeing a consequence of industrialization. And we're finding out that in Vietnam and elsewhere, it's extremely easy to contaminate the environment, food chain, people with very persistent synthetic chemicals, which in some cases are extremely toxic. And they stick around a very long time, which is why these are called persistent organic pollutants, or POPs. And dioxin is the most toxic of this group. We have a lesson to be learned, both in Vietnam and elsewhere. If we're careless, we can cause a great deal of harm to ourselves.
Now think about some of the issues and topics that they've been focusing on as he lays out this type of environmental eco-disaster that is a global thing. It's not just Vietnam, because the same empire is casting its web of death all over the planet. Yet, it's all about Kobe. It's all about Lacey Peterson. It's all about this irrelevant nonsense to keep you off track about getting a clean cup of water in this barbaric, decadent economic system.
Dying system.
Next, Dr. Shecker describes the level of dioxin found in a person in Nam. So let's check this out. We'll take it from there.
The recent finding, the highest dioxin level in Vietnamese blood, was found in someone we sampled a few years ago, but very recently, is distressing. It means that this persistent reservoir of dioxin is just sitting there and getting into the food supply and getting into people, just as though the spraying were going on today. I mean, it's not the spraying. People don't get this into their body by having it sprayed. It gets in by the food chain. So that's the thing to keep in mind. The spraying is over, but consumption of dioxins into people's body is just the same as it was during the Vietnam War. We believe that rain and flooding is moving the dioxin, and we're not sure exactly what is happening in the lakes and rivers.
Okay, now, see, in certain ways, this is not much different than Monsanto and the Franken foods and all the genetic engineering and destruction of the ecosystem that these corporations do on another level of how they're trying to manipulate and control the environment and the fallout. Well, whatever is whatever. Because it's the same type of mentality of those human beings that think that they have the right to privatize the world, commit war in the name of controlling other people's resources in the world, and manipulate the ecosystem for their own political and economic benefit. It's the same mentality that, and it's the same type of process that produces wars, whether it's a war through the bombs of Agent Orange, or whether it's the war through the process of the genetically modifying the systems of food production like Monsanto and these Franken monsters. Now, to show some of the connections that also go on, we have Terry Allen, who describes how a while back, dioxin contamination in Belgium and its foods and feedlots contaminated the world food market, and what media systems did and did not cover it, and how this is interrelated. Check this out.
The contamination took place in January in Belgium, and the Belgian government has still not figured out where the contamination took place. What they do know is that tons of poison fat, fat laced with PCBs and dioxin, was sold to an animal feed company. And that animal feed company made 1,800 tons of animal feed out of the contaminated dioxin-laced fat. And nobody to this day can figure out where that fat came from, whether it was industrial oil that was accidentally added to what was supposed to be a food batch, or what exactly it was. Most of it stayed in Belgium, but it was also sent to farms in France and Holland, so that the feed directly fed animals in those countries. But then the animals in those countries ate the feed. Dioxin is stored in fat, and the meat and eggs and dairy products from those animals were then spread all over the world. There is barely a country that did not receive products from Belgium, France, and Holland that could potentially have been contaminated during the four-month period. The contamination took place in January. It was March before the Belgian government discovered that there was a problem when chickens started dropping dead. And it was the end of May before they announced the problem. They sat on it for a month, knowing that there was dioxin-contaminated feed going out, and they did not release that information to the public or to other governments. Did release it. The information came out a couple weeks before the election, and the ruling government fell because the scandal was so extensive. And while there has not been a lot of publicity about this particular dioxin contamination in the U.S., in the rest of the world, especially in the European Union, it's been headline news for months.
Now, here you have a situation where... Now, this doesn't happen through the quote-unquote conventional war of dropping bombs, but this happens in Belgium through another form of conventional warfare, corporate farming and these giant feedlots and stuff like that. And here you have the state trying to withhold the evidence, meaning Belgium, and you have various media systems trying to suppress and look the other way, at least in the States, because it's not in their interest to let people know after they've already, or their corporations within their country have already purchased this material, that this food has been contaminated. So you have a continuous cycle, whether it's through the feedlots of the world in these giant corporate farms, or the war mechanisms that have taken place in Vietnam. The continuous cycle of death and spreading of dioxin is endemic within the capitalist system. Next, Alan addresses
right.
How the alarm bells of what's up, because chickens were falling dead. But if they were larger animals eating this contaminated feed, a lot of dioxin-contaminated produce, what would have happened then? Check this out.
The dioxin involved is a dioxin that is fatal relatively small doses to chickens. It wouldn't have affected cows or pigs, but with symptoms. Of course, it would have affected them by being absorbed into their fat and passed through the food chain. So, in fact, we wouldn't have known about it, which raises the question of how many other contaminations do we not find out about, since there is not routine testing for dioxin in most European countries and also not in the U.S. Dioxin is known as one of the dirty dozen. It is a confirmed class 1 carcinogen, according to both the U.S. government and the World Health Organization. And not only does it promote cancer, but it has effects on the reproductive system in terms of the development of reproductive system and also the functioning. It also has behavioral effects. It's a pretty nasty chemical. And it's stored in your body. So the half-life of dioxin that you get in your body is estimated at 6 to 11 years. It's also passed through mother's milk to babies, because the milk, of course, has fat content. And anything in the fat content passes it on.
Okay, so you have a situation where a class 1 carcinogen is being allowed to not be tested that thoroughly. And only when chickens drop, which are much smaller animals than cattle and pigs and stuff, then all of a sudden the flags go up. Because they don't want to know. They don't want to find out the fact that the food supply is being contaminated by the system that is depriving humanity and other life forms of its basic needs of existence. So the real class one carcinogen is the capitalist system that takes place globally and the state apparatus that helps serve to protect these various institutions throughout the world. This is an abomination. But once again, you don't see the corporate media, which is tied into the state.
That's right.
Discussing this because it's all about Kobe.
You don't want to alarm the people. I mean, they really do say you don't want to alarm the people now. You don't want to make the people unnecessarily at it.
But you can alarm them about some quote-unquote sexual predator
bullshit
moving into their, you know, neighborhood and all of that and flash this picture 2,000 times. Now, to show how some of this stuff ties in, we have Hugh Kaufman and Walter Haim. They are part of those who are involved in testing toxic, you know, contamination, stuff like that. Recently, the White House told the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, not to warn the public of the dangers of the toxic problem as a result of the World Trade Towers falling down. Let's see what they have to say and tie things up from here. Check this out.
The Inspector General told your local congressman, Congressman Nadler, many months ago that they would publish their report by May of this year. That report never came out. Apparently that report was leaked to the New York Times last week. I haven't seen the report, and very few people have. Basically, the report again documents what the ombudsman had documented over a year and a half ago, that the Environmental Protection Agency did not follow their usual procedures in a major emergency such as when the World Trade Towers came down, and instead told the public that things were safe without even having the monitoring done to determine whether it's safe or not. The significance of that is that up until the World Trade Towers came down, the Environmental Protection Agency had procedures to follow to protect the public if a terrorist attack occurred, and those procedures weren't followed, and tens of thousands of people were put at and are at health risk because EPA did not follow its usual procedures. The first responders, of course, received a major acute problems, and of course, we're seeing now that over half of those first responders are sick, and the concern is that a large number of them will die very early because of cancer and other health effects because EPA did not do its job properly.
Okay, so this about says it all. Here you have a situation where the trade towers collapse. There's all types of contamination that goes up, and the U.S. Thugs within the Pentagon withhold the EPA from releasing the proper type of investigation and things of that nature because they're more concerned with getting things back in motion, having those clowns back in Wall Street so they can help economically pillage the world and stuff like that, other than cleaning the atmosphere. Even though the first responders, in other words, people who came to the site to try to save people and clean it up and stuff like that, now half of them are sick. Just like large segments of the Vietnamese people are sick. Just like a number of people who ate the food that was first shown to be polluted in Belgium are sick. You have the same type of entities who are more concerned with profit than people and the ecosystem. And you see it take place in every segment of our lives, whether it's the World Trade whether it's the wars that they commit in Nam or whether it's in the food supply. They are more concerned with their own economic systems and advantages than anything else. Now, as we tie this up, Kaufman describes how the World Trade Tower's collapse should have been diagnosed and tested by the EPA, like a chemical plant explosions are when they explode. Check this out as we close this out.
Well, I just think that this is an unprecedented breach of public trust. When I first saw the images of the impact in the World Trade Center, and when I saw the towers coming down, I knew that that dust that was flying out of the towers was asbestos contaminated, because I knew that in 1971, Mount Sinai School of Medicine had done a study that showed that the asbestos was used to insulate the superstructure of the building. Afterwards, when I saw the fire at World Trade Center number 7, I knew that underneath the building was a giant substation that controlled the delivery of electricity to all of southern Manhattan. And I knew that there were huge transformers that were insulated with this oil that potentially could contain polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs. And perhaps most importantly, I knew that there was a high-voltage line from that giant substation to another substation in Brooklyn. And I knew that if the building collapsed, then the line would be severed and perhaps tens of thousands of gallons of oil would flow into the hole and catch fire. And if those materials contain PCBs, then the burning of that oil would be perhaps an unprecedented catastrophe because of the production of very, very toxic dioxins and dibenzofurans, which are among the most toxic compounds known to science. And indeed, afterwards, PCBs were detected in air, in dust samples all around the site, and perhaps for the first time ever, dioxin was detected in ambient air. So I just think that the EPA should have alerted the public to these problems. They should have protected the workers at the site. And I tried to alert the authorities to this problem that fall when the fires were still burning. And, you know, I just think that this is a very, very important issue that needs additional investigation.
Now, is there any more evidence that the U.S. empire and those who align themselves has to go? We're back to dioxin again, from PCBs being thrown up into the air in an ambient way that had never been recorded before, to giant substations with oil that Boy George did not want investigated. We know about the students sick. We know about now people who are the first people to come up to check out the site, the first responders, half of them are sick, just like we know about the Gulf War syndrome. It has claimed thousands of lives. Yet, with all of this, from Vietnam to Iraq to New York, it's the same class of people who are dying by this mechanism.
First of all, you've got to understand that when the World Trade Towers came down, it was much the same as if a chemical plant blew up. Things that periodically happen, especially around the Houston area. And as a result of that, for over 20 years, the agency has procedures for taking samples and communicating to the public, evacuating the public, etc. I think the difference between the World Trade Center catastrophe and when a chemical plant goes up is that there's a higher density of population in the New York area than, say, around the Houston Ship Channel. In the mid-1990s, then-President Clinton created a presidential directive that set the procedures based on our 20 years experience for responding to something like that. Major problems aren't just asbestos and PCBs when the trade towers came down. You also had a tremendous amount of lead. Every computer has 7 pounds of lead, and I think you know how many computers were in that building. Also, the smoke detectors have radioactive americium, and there are tens of thousands of those smoke detectors that were in that building, plus the ultra-fine particulates. We had testimony in our two 11-hour hearings that Congressman Nadler asked us to hold, where we had the experts who had investigated the Kuwaiti oil field fires and found that a month after the World Trade Towers came down, the ultrafine particulates a mile north of the site, those levels were higher than when the Kuwaiti oil field fires were burning. So I think there was tremendous documentation ultimately about the magnitude of the problem and the impacts to working spaces and living spaces in New York. And the agency did not follow its usual procedures for cleanup and communication with the public that they had followed in other catastrophes when chemical plants, for example, or refineries would blow up. And I think that was the concern. Now, the Inspector General's draft report apparently, according to the Times, claims that that was done as a result of White House pressure. But I'm not even sure that report will ever see the light of day, since it was promised by the Inspector General to Congressman Nadler to be published last May.
Well, that about says it all for the U.S. empire. And it's clear where their priorities are. You're disposable if you're part of a class, whether it's a class that was the peasants of Vietnam, the class that is engulfed in Iraq's depleted uranium in Iraq, or a G.I. Joe soldier that was silly enough to go fight for the U.S. empire, or a first responder, construction worker, or medic who found himself in the World Trade Towers, PCBs, and other destructions. So instead of following the illusion of the American myth, following dreams of so-called role models, following these cascading false promises that are nothing but illusions and waterfalls, it's time we follow our own ideas about making this world a humane place to live in while we still have the chance. Until the next time, Slave Revolt. Out.